Welcome to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. That was Sly and the Family Stone with Dance to the Music, a single that came out a decade before the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive and the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever, a movie which is widely credited with starting the disco craze in the 70s. But actually, disco was thriving in black-owned clubs in New York City long before John Travolta showed off his moves on the screen. Noel Henkin shares the history of black-owned clubs in his new book, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. It's more than just a story of a few clubs in New York City. It's really the story of how black entrepreneurs made a place for themselves. Noel Henkin, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure.
Now, before we learn about the history of the disco clubs that you and your friends started, why do you think that this history has been forgotten? I mean, do you think Saturday Night Fever should get so much credit for the disco craze?
I think it should get a lot of credit because what it did was fuel something that had already started and had built up a great deal of momentum. But when Saturday Night Fever came out, our five nightclubs received a shot in the arm.
Mm.
We had a lot more customers coming in. So, yeah, it had a big influence on the disco era. It made it more of a craze. It existed. It was growing. It had a lot of momentum. There were already lots of discotheques across the country. And what Saturday Night Fever did was explode that interest in dancing and discotheques, so much so that it was a double-edged sword. It created interest in disco to the point where even serious musicians like Miles Davis started becoming more electronic in some of their offerings. And people were turning out, I'm not pointing to Miles Davis now, but people were turning out literally garbage songs and garbage associations with the word disco. It just deteriorated the value of the word. Now, the music never lost popularity. It continued to be very strong, but there was a segment of society, rock and rollers, rockers they call them, who hated disco because there were over 200 radio stations that switched from rock to disco, and boy, did that piss them off. So there was an element that hated disco music, but for most of America and most of the world, disco music never lost its favor.
Well, we are going to cover that whole arc, but I want to start way back when you were in college. I guess that's when you discovered dance parties. Tell me a little bit about that that discovery and what it did to your life.
Well, you know, we went to house parties a lot in college, and the activity there was to dance. Of course, they had, you know, conversations and so forth, but the biggest activity was dancing. And the way the music was during that time frame, talking about the 60s, there were specific dances for specific songs, and there were hot crazes for certain dances, like the mashed potatoes. It seemed like every month or two there was a new dance, and the pace began to quicken so much to the point where eventually specific dances faded away and people did their own individual things. And that actually led to the deterioration of dancing and the loss of the coordinated steps. You know, it's hard to hold hands if you don't have coordination. If you don't know what steps you're taking, you can't lead your partner properly.
Interesting.
So it's a very interesting trajectory. But what we did was transition from house parties where we played to recorded music to fraternity and social club dances in college where we danced to live bands. And that was a big thing. The music from live bands was far superior to recorded music. And it was so much more exhilarating. When we graduated from college, the technology to create recorded sounds that were able to compete with the quality of live music became more affordable and more prevalent. It existed for a while, but it was expensive, I guess, and not many people were taking advantage of it. We did, and there was a sociological factor that happened for us that probably would never be repeated.
I want to get to that, but first, Tell us about this group of friends who started several discos in New York City. Is called The Best of Friends. And I just want to say, I think that is such a fabulous name for any endeavor to remind you maybe of what got you started when things get rough. I don't know, but I just love the name.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, The Best of Friends was strictly a social club. We got together to give dances just for fun and as a social outlet. We would hire popular bands like Jimmy Castor and Joe Cuba, who was really hot back then with his Latin boogaloo sounds. Beep, beep, bang, bang. I don't know if you remember that song. We also had bands like Junior Walker and the All-Stars, Shotgun and Cleo's Mood, and those songs were really great for dancing, and that was the activity that we focused on.
So when did you decide to make a business of the dance party, basically?
You know, we never really made that decision. It kind of just happened. It was a sociological phenomenon. New York City had a very high crime rate, extreme budget shortfalls, very few uniform police officers, and city services had deteriorated to the point where a lot of white-collar workers, people, left New York City for the suburbs. What that led to was venues, in some cases fairly prestigious venues, hurting for customers. When we knocked on the door and said, we'd like to bring our crowd in, we were welcomed. We would not have been welcomed under different circumstances, but we were then. And so we cut deals where we took the door, we charged admission, and the establishment took the bar, which they have to do legally, of course. So it was a really nice arrangement. After a couple of years, one by one, those arrangements dissipated for various reasons. Leases ran out, or they didn't want to renew, or someone wanted to retire, one of the owners wanted to retire, or go in a different direction. So we started building our own nightclubs. And in 1973, we built our first one in Queens called Lucifer's. And then we did that, a relatively small club, to learn how to order liquor, how to hire, how to manage a bar, how to operate the whole discotheque environment. Then we moved back.
So I'm imagining that in this setting, now you're having to get the licenses, not the establishment. You're having to get the licenses. I'm wondering, was there any hesitation on the part of the city, these young 20-something black men? I mean, did you come up against any racism or even ageism, people doubting your ability?
Yes. Back then, you had to have a cabaret license to allow dancing in large establishments. Our Leviticus was large. We had a CFO of 875, I believe it was. We had to have a cabaret license, which the city issues. State liquor license was not a problem. You got the liquor license, but you couldn't have dancing without a cabaret license. And that cabaret license was extremely difficult for us to get. The city investigated our neighbors, talked to our family members. They wanted to make sure that we weren't a gang or drug barons or something, because they couldn't figure out where a group of young black guys, we were in our early 20s, we would get the money to build clubs in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
That's my supposition anyway. It took about 6 months before we could get the license. So we had the place built. They had to do an inspection. So after it was built, we waited another 6 months of paying $3,500 a month rent. So that's a lot of money that we'll never get back.
Mm-hmm.
And we had lots of money, but who wants to lose that kind of momentum and that kind of money?
Right. I'm just trying to picture your clubs. And I think that clubs have kind of a stereotype of being kind of wild parties and maybe some out of control behavior. I mean, how did you manage to keep things under control in your clubs?
We had strict policies, both for admission and behavior. One of the things we learned and we understood is that if people are required to dress up a certain way, it can affect their behavior. We required jackets, no sneakers, no jeans. You had to remove your hat. If you didn't comply with that, you did not get in. It didn't matter who you were. We turned away some major celebrities because they had jeans. We turned away a major drug kingpin who came in with jeans. We turned them away, and we were a little nervous about it. But our bouncer knew him, and that helped a lot. So, you know, by having consistent policies, now, once inside, if someone smoked or, marijuana or did some other kind of drug, we would not only escort them out the club, we would ban them for a period of time, like a month, depending on the severity of the infraction. So we had a policy where they would be banned. And if they tried to come back in, we knew who they were. We would not let them in until the ban was over. So that helped to maintain a certain level of decorum. All the people who came to enjoy the evening and socialize. Even if the handful of few hustlers and gangsters who came in also. You know, when you have a club in a city like New York City, or any city really, you're going to have a wide swath of people, from CEOs to mailroom clerks. From we had Elizabeth Taylor to Rick James, from Nick Nolte to Arthur Ashe. And we had elected officials, foreign dignitaries from the UN who frequented our club, from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, a lot from the Caribbean. But we also had a few drug lords, kingpins, and we knew who they were, and they respected our clubs because we respected them. In fact, one of our clubs, Justine's, was in a building owned in part by Maddie the Horse Iannello, part of the Genovese crime family. And while he was our landlord with that club, we never asked for a favor. We never was late with our rent. And back then, if you were straight, as we were, meaning you abided by the laws, the mafia didn't really mess with you.
Mm. If
you asked for a favor or a loan, all bets are off.
Mm. I understand there's a story of a mysterious phone call when somebody actually tried to extort money from you for protection. You had a mysterious benefactor. Would you tell us that story?
Yes. Two men came to our club one night, one black, one white, and asked to speak to the owner. Tony Cooper was our president at the time, and they went to Tony and said, "Some people want to see you at the door." When Tony got there, he walked with them outside because the music was so loud. They actually walked around the block. The black guy was someone Tony had seen before and knew him as a customer in our club. The white guy, he did not know. The white guy said, "You guys have a good business here. We can help you. We can protect it for you because all kinds of bad things can happen to your club. You could have fights. You could have problems. You could have union issues. We will protect it for you for $500 a week." And Tony said, "Well, I don't know if I can't make that decision. I got to talk to my partners. Can you give me a few days? Let me talk to my partners and get back to you." So they said, "Okay, we'll come back in a few days." So the next morning, Tony called our attorney, David Schwartz, who was the big attorney for almost all the clubs in that area of town, including a lot of clubs that were owned by or controlled by Matty the Horse. He was the Times Square guy. He was in charge of that area and for the mob. And David Schwartz, our attorney, said, "I'm going to give you a phone number. You call this number when they come back and say, 'This is Tony Cooper,' and then you hand the phone to Johnny." That's the white guy, Johnny.
Hmm.
And that's all you got to do. When you finish, destroy the number. So Tony waited for Johnny to come back. He came back. He called the number. "Hello, this is Tony Cooper. Hold on, please." Passed the phone to Johnny, who was belligerent at first and then became very humble and modest. Oh, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. No, it'll never happen again." He apologized, and he turned to Tony after he hung up the phone and said, "I'm sorry. You'll never see me again."
Hmm.
And he left. So that was a really remarkable situation, and I credit Tony, our president, Tony Cooper, with how he handled the relationship with these big-time gangsters. He treated them with respect, He never looked down his nose at them, and they in turn treated him with respect. But because we were good tenants for Maddie, I don't know who was on the phone. No one knows. My suspicion is that it might have been someone in Maddie's organization, and this guy Johnny was probably a junior guy trying to make some money on the side for himself. I'm thinking that's a possibility. I don't know.
We're speaking with Noel Henkin. He's the author of After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. I just want to talk for a second about the need among your clients for what you were doing. Why did these clubs get to be so popular? Was there no, you know, was there nowhere else that people were going? Did you have a lot of competition?
Initially, we didn't have much competition. Of course, we had competitors, but not as pervasive as our clubs were. What happened was 1970, I started working in Midtown Manhattan, and there was a whole cadre of young black folks beginning to enter the corporate world. Not many in any one company, but a few at various companies. You aggregate it, an emerging segment in Midtown. And there was no place where they felt comfortable going in Midtown. They would typically leave the office and go uptown if they wanted to hang out or go to one of the neighborhoods in the outer boroughs where they lived. We saw that as an opportunity, especially given that so many venues were hurting for customers. And what we created was an environment where we played the music that our crowd liked and created an environment where they could dance. And dancing was very popular right across the board. Everyone danced, liked to dance. And, you know, from our dances with live bands, people dressed up, and we required that same dress. People came from the office with suits and ties. Women had business suits on. So when the discos that we first started occurred, that's how everyone dressed, in business attire. And it was really fascinating to see them turn into a ball of sweat in their business suit. But that's what they did. And gradually, the outfits got more casual. And always with a jacket, though, but the ties, they would lose the tie, wear colorful shirts, bell bottoms, and so forth. That's that evolved gradually.
And let's talk about the music. You referred to this earlier just briefly, but you didn't have live music. You had DJs. And why did you go that route instead of having bands?
Well, it was a lot less expensive and more convenient. And when you think about it, if you have high-quality sound, you have access to millions of different sounds with recorded music. You have a whole world to play with in terms of creating a musical experience that's unique and special and curated for the moment. With live bands, you don't have that opportunity. You have what that band can play. But with recorded music, you have access to all bands and everybody who performs. And so with the enhanced quality and high fidelity of really powerful, crystal clear speakers and two turntables, it created an opportunity for DJs to not only play high quality music, but to manipulate some of these songs. For example, when Theme from Shaft came out, it was very exciting. The movie Shaft was a big hit. For blacks and whites, it was a hit right across the board. But we took that song, Theme from Shaft, my DJ partners. And they had two copies of it, and they would continue that song for like 10 minutes by playing the bridge over and over from one turntable to the next in such a way that the dancers never missed a step. This was a new experience. This was brand new to me, and I believe to our crowd. I think others had done it in the gay community prior to us, but we weren't aware of that. And we had a tremendous reaction from those who were there. It was euphoric. They had never experienced anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I worked the door typically, and I heard the comments on the way out as people did the penguin up the steps and out onto 58th Street. You know, it was a sight to behold.
So how long would you say was the heyday of the clubs that you ran, and why did you decide ultimately to get out?
Yeah, I'll tell you, for a very good reason. We started in 1971 with clubs we did not own, where we promoted events on certain nights. 1971 to 73, we had 7 events a week on average at 5 different clubs. And that was really what created the momentum. Then we had the confidence to build our own clubs. We spent millions building 5 clubs, 3 in Manhattan, 1 in Brooklyn, 1 in Queens. But we had the confidence because we knew the crowd would be there. With Leviticus, which was our flagship, we opened that in November 74. And 12 years later, in 1986, we signed a long-term lease initially. 12 years later, they wanted to raise the rent from $6,000 to close to $30,000 a month.
Ouch.
New York City had recovered from the economic crisis. People mm-hmm. were beginning to pour back in. Everybody was raising rents to ridiculous levels. Today, you can't do what we did back in 1971 or 73 as promoters or club owners because the cost is prohibitive. That's why we got out of it.
And you referred at the very beginning of our conversation to kind of some backlash that disco faced. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that. I mean, it became so popular, maybe became cliche, and you said people started producing music that was not that good. In your book, you kind of refer to some racist overtones to this backlash to disco. Would you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it was reported in many media outlets that the backlash was not just about the music, but also the culture shift that it represented. In 1976, the Billboard Top 100 chart was dominated by disco sounds. The top 10 was almost all disco music. But it wasn't all by black folks, although it was primarily by black folks. You had the Bee Gees, of course, who lived on the top 10 pretty much for quite a while. But there were, you know, so many black groups that dominated the charts, and rock and roll was pushed aside. And a lot of rockers resented that. They did not want to get dressed up. We required that. And other discotheques required it. They didn't want to pay admission. That was required for all discotheques. And they didn't want to learn how to dance. And that was required to get the girl. So you had a DJ in Chicago by the name of Steve Dahl, who was friendly with the son of the owner of the Chicago White Sox. And they put together an idea for a promotion because the White Sox was getting maybe 15, 20,000 fans per game, which or even less. It was kind of a poor attendance at that time. So they put together a promotion where you bring a disco record, and you get it for 99 cents. And Steve Dahl was going to blow up and burn these disco records on the playing field between the two games of a doubleheader. And he did that. And it actually led to a real raucous situation where hundreds of fans stormed the field and were reveling in the idea of disco sucks. They had a lot of T-shirts with disco sucks. And they brought not just disco records, but records by black folks. That's what they brought, records by black folks. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just disco. And that's where some of the attitude came from. The White Sox forfeited the second game, but the disco sucks mantra spread like wildfire and became a negative, especially with all the disco duck, disco was attached to so many things that were corny and inappropriate and garbage, poorly done. So the word disco really got a bad name. We never really embraced the word disco. We started off using the word discotheque on occasion, but we quickly got away from disco when the word disco became synonymous with poor taste.
Well, Noel Henkin, when you left this business, you went on to do many other things. I'd like to know maybe just a couple lessons that you took with you into your later work.
Good question. Yes, one of the things that I learned that was very valuable to me is how important it is, I went into marketing, to respect everyone. If you respect everyone, you get a better result. And I'll give you an example. My experience with my partners and dealing with so many different kinds of people coming into the club, including people who could hurt us and ruin our business. We showed respect to everyone. We demanded respect in return, and they gave it. And I think that was maybe the biggest lesson I got from the nightclub business.
Noel Henkin is the author of After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. Thank you so much for sharing your history with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
Thank you. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Great to have you along for Constant Wonder today. In this hour about music, we're now going to turn our attention to Prince. I was dreaming when I wrote this. Forgive me if it goes astray. But when I woke up this morning, could have sworn it was Judgment Day. But before we can talk about his music, we're going to have to start with the polka. And what would the polka have to do with Prince? A lot, it turns out. And the story is actually the story of Prince's hometown, Minneapolis. To explain, we've got on the line with us Rashad Shabazz. He's a human geographer, and we're going to get to the bottom of what that is. He's at Arizona State University, and we've read about his work in The Conversation. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tenery. Thank you for having me.
All right. So I've dropped a few teases here, but before we get to the polka or to Prince, tell us what a human geographer is.
Yes, a human geographer is someone who studies how place shapes human beings and how human beings shape place. You know, we all come from somewhere, and those wheres, they inform us, they shape our eating habits, they shape how we dress, they shape our language, they shape our exposure to the sun, they shape a whole range of factors. And what human geographers try to do is to look at how those things shape us, how they shape our politics, our sense of identity, our culture, and how in turn we inform those places by building cities or by living off the land. So that's essentially what a human geographer is.
All right. And so why is this study important to the story of Prince and his hometown, Minneapolis?
Minneapolis is always left out of the conversation whenever we talk about Prince. In the wake of his death in 2016, numerous fans were just, you know, thrown into grief, myself included. And there have been books and studies about Prince since that point. But all of it has talked about almost exclusively his genius. And there's reason for that. Prince was an absolute musical genius. He was the most important popular musician that we've ever seen in this country. But at the same time, who Prince became as a musician was profoundly informed by the city that he grew up in. And what my research is attempting to do is to bring the conversation of Minneapolis into our discussion about Prince.
Which means we've got to start with the polka that I mentioned. Why the polka?
Well, the polka is really important, and it says a lot about the music that Prince did and many other musicians, and it also says a lot about the evolution of the city of Minneapolis. Minneapolis was a mill town. It was founded in the middle part of the 19th century, and it brought, you know, Northeasterners, people from mostly Boston, Maine, and New York City into the city to work in the growing mill district. Well, it also attracted many people from Western Europe, particularly a large number of Scandinavians. Minnesota and Minneapolis has the largest number of immigrant Scandinavians than any other city or state in the country. And when those Scandinavians moved into Minneapolis in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, they brought their sense of identity, their culture, and a big part of that was their music. So you had, you know, the Swedish that would bring their folk songs. You had Norwegians who would also bring their folk songs. You had a small number of Icelandic people who would also bring their music. And by the latter part of the 19th century, in Minneapolis, but in other cities that also had growing numbers of immigrant populations, we start to see the creation of polka. And particularly in the Northeast down into the Midwest, we had what's called the Polka Belt, which is all of these European immigrants who came mid-century to the latter part of the early 20th century, moving into cities. And that creates the fusion of polka. Polka is essentially the fusion or mixture of European folk music. So it's blending, you know, Icelandic folk music with Norwegian and Swedish folk music. And Minneapolis developed a very unique and particular kind of polka scene that was a reflection of its migratory pattern. So it was these sort of Icelandic and Norwegian and largely Scandinavian. And that polka scene really begins to take off in Minneapolis around the turn of the 20th century.
And I want to say something about polka, because polka is not something you go and watch. Polka is something you go and do, right?
Right, right. It is a collective, very festive art form, and it's really rooted around celebration. So Minneapolis begins to develop this in the early 20th century, and it really, really explodes. And with some changes that began to happen in the school system around education and teaching immigrant children and first and second generation immigrant children and poor kids how to read, write, and play music, the Minneapolis polka scene really takes off in the early part of the 20th century.
Well, let's talk then about the music education, since you mentioned that. You've got, okay, the parents are going out and polkaing, is that how you say it, on the weekends?
Yeah.
And so the parents are dancing, and there is a lot of music brought by these immigrants. The kids at school, you've argued, in Minneapolis had some advantages that other kids around the United States really didn't have.
Absolutely. So as the polka scene is taking off and music is becoming a fundamental part of how the city orients itself, music is the sort of through line that is connecting all of the different immigrant groups and the different American racial groups. Music is the thing that's sort of holding people together in the city. Around 1910, the city decides to make a change to its public education system. They make music education mandatory, and this has an impact that really reverberates over the next century, because the first thing it does is that by making it mandatory, it means that students cannot matriculate onto the next grade if they don't pass music. So it's not an elective. It's just as important as math and science and history and English. The second thing it does is it allows for these children of immigrants and these children of, you know, poor and working class people, as well as those who are middle class, to have top-notch musical education where they learn to read music, write music, and play music, as well as to sing. And as it gets woven into the public school system, it raises the musical literacy of all the children. It was spearheaded and created by Thaddeus Paul Giddings, and he was a revolutionary music teacher who was born in Minnesota, took a job in Illinois, then was recruited back to Minneapolis in the early 20th century. And part of that recruitment was the creation of this system. So what it does is it democratizes music education. It puts music in the hands of children, and it creates a universal language that the children of Minneapolis, across race, across class, across gender, and across ethnic lives, can collectively engage in. They can speak to each other in one language, the language of music. It was so successful and so revolutionary that it fundamentally changes how music operates in the city. Now, with a population of musically literate children, there is this explosion in the band scene. In the 1940s, Minneapolis had school children who could, one in every six, could read music, write music, and play at least one instrument. That is phenomenal. That is absolutely revolutionary. And that level of music literacy filters throughout the city, so that by the time the 50s and 60s come along and we have new migrants, particularly black migrants from the South, and we have this growing Black community in North and in South Phoenix, those children are also getting exposed to this music.
And I want to talk about that in just a minute, but just I want to clarify, because I'm thinking as a parent of children in today's public education system, sometimes you have to provide your own instrument. But I think what I hear you saying is that not only did they make music education mandatory, these school systems must have been providing the instruments and investing in, you know, in this kind of, you know, in the trumpets and the pianos and the bass drums.
Yes, the school system provided all the teachers, they provided all the sheet music, and they provided the vast majority of the instruments. Some there was some small fee that some of the parents paid, but it was well within their reach. So it wasn't, you know, hundreds of dollars. It was really just a couple of dollars to keep things moving, but overwhelmingly the school system covered more than 90% of the cost.
You're listening to Constant Wonder, and we're speaking with Rashad Shabazz. He is a human geography at Arizona geographer, excuse me, at Arizona State University. And we're talking about the history of Minneapolis as far as music education and musical cultural identity. And we're going to see how that actually came to affect the megastar Prince and this idea of having free musical instruments provided by the school system is actually going to play into his story. And we're going to get more of that when we come back after a short break. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and we are speaking with Rashad Shabazz. He is an associate professor in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. And we've been talking about the history of Minneapolis as it relates to music and as it relates to the life and work of Prince. Now, before the break, you had mentioned, Rashad, about kind of a second wave of immigration that came to Minneapolis. We had in the 19th century European immigrants and immigrants, white immigrants from the northeast of the United States who brought their folk music, and how polka represented kind of a fusion of various European types of folk music. But then there is this second wave from the American South in the beginning of the earliest 20th century. Will you tell us about that?
Yes. Yeah, so the Great Black Migration happens between the First and Second World Wars. Effectively, half of the Black population South moves north in search of better jobs, better life, and escaping racism and Jim Crow in the South. Minneapolis began to get a steady stream around 1920, 1930. And because of the location of Minneapolis and the fact that there are no direct train lines from the South leading up to the North to Minneapolis, which is how the vast majority of Black people left the South following those train lines, Minneapolis got a smaller number than did, say, Cleveland, Ohio, Chicago, New York, and other big cities. But they did get a sizable group. And that group brought with them the blues, and they brought jazz with them. And that influx of the tempo and the phrasing of blues and the energetic play of jazz injected a new sound into the Minneapolis music scene. And that had a profound impact on the music that was played between like the 1930s and the 1950s. And what we began to see is that in the developing Black communities, jazz and blues become an important music source.
Let's take just a listen to some of what maybe this blues might have sounded like. Now, that certainly has some energy that kind of reminds me of that polka little clip that we heard earlier. I'm wondering, what did these migrants who brought the jazz and the blues do with this music and do with the music that they found there already in Minneapolis?
So what the blues is able to do is it's able to create a new way of organizing music. It's able to use just a few chords. I'm going to do just a tiny bit of music theory, and I think the listeners will be able to hold on to it. It's able to use just a few music chords, and it's able to put them in a constant rotation to allow for others to step into the song and to improvise, like to play a guitar riff or a horn riff or to sing while there's a steady harmony of these three chords going in constant rotation. And what they're able to do is they're able to use this blues, the 12-bar blues, and they're able to marry the 12-bar blues with some of the existing music genres that are in the city, the folk music, even some of the opera and classical music, and it creates a new way of producing sound in the city, and it fuses with these other genres. And so by the 1950s, you have people like Prince's parents. Right? Prince's father was born and raised in Minneapolis. He attended Minneapolis public schools. He was trained under the sittings that T.P. Giddings created in the early 20th century, and he learns not only to play the piano and other instruments, he also learns to write his compositions down, but he's drawing on the music that is around him, and he's finding ways to integrate that into the system of music that was played in his community, which was the blues.
When we talk about his community, were the musical communities separate? Was there ever any, cross-pollination? I'm not just in theory, but in, like, performance. So would black musicians be performing for white audiences? And would white audiences go and hear this new kind of fusion that maybe was happening in the black community?
So between the 30s and the 50s, there was a segregation of sound that was happening in the city. So while there's this kind of fusion that's happening among some of the black musicians and a few of the white musicians, the performances were all segregated. Black musicians were not allowed to play in many of the downtown Minneapolis clubs. A few of them were able to, but overwhelmingly they could not. But white patrons wanted jazz and blues. So you had white musicians learning how to play the 12-bar blues, picking up some jazz chops, and then playing it in these downtown white clubs. But because you had black musicians who were trained in the schools, they were learning to play some of these sort of standard, Western European songs, and they were also finding ways to play music among their white classmates. But largely we were seeing a kind of segregation of sound where white musicians were playing black music for white listeners and black musicians were playing black music for black listeners while learning all of these other kinds of music, sort of like top 40 pop standards, but it creates a sense of dexterity, and it's the black musicians particularly who have to develop the most dexterity, because as the 50s ends, there's a little bit of space for black musicians to now play in some of those downtown clubs, but they couldn't just play the blues, they couldn't just play jazz, they had to learn how to play polka. They had to learn how to play Norwegian folk music. They had to learn how to play some of the standards or the popular polka sounds. Right? So they're playing all of that, plus they're playing jazz, plus they're playing the blues. And this is when the Minneapolis sound really gets its legs, because the innovation brought by black musicians from the South to the North, jazz and the blues, particularly in that 12-bar blues, and they learn how to play all of these other sounds that are happening in the city. They find ways to fuse them together and to build a new kind of music by the 1950s. And Prince's father in particular was one of those early innovators who could play not only black music, but all of these other styles in the city.
So Prince is getting a good education at home, and you've written a little bit about the time he spent in the music classroom at school. Will you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah, so Prince showed early on. He showed a gift for music. He wrote his first song when he was 4 years old, according to his mother. He was trained under this system created by Thaddeus Paul Giddings. So he had, you know, music every day. He showed a real interest and vigor toward music. But it was in his high school years that really things take off for Prince. Prince's high school music teacher was the drummer for Ray Charles. Ray Charles, for those
wow.
who do not know, is the father of modern rhythm and blues, where he begins in the 1950s fusing the sounds of rhythm, the sounds of blues, that 12-bar blues, with the sounds of gospel, and creating this new genre which has been called rhythm and blues. His drummer was teaching Prince in high school. So to have someone with that kind of that kind of musical knowledge, who was a working musician, it's just another illustration of how committed the Minneapolis school system was to teaching music. But Prince also had access to technology. He learned how to work on some of the new music technology, the reel-to-reel tape. He was learning how to do that. Plus, he was also soaking up everything he could from his music teachers, all the people around him, and he begins to get into bands. So by the time Prince is 14, 15 years old, he's in bands. He is really working on his chops, and he's also learning to play all of the instruments that he became known for playing throughout his career. He starts as a kid on the piano because his father was a pianist, but by the time Prince is 16, he can basically play everything on the stage.
I want to listen to a little bit of music that might kind of give us that flavor. We're going to listen to a clip from Uptown. And would you just kind of preface this and tell us what we should be listening for? Is this a standard, an example of a standard genre, or is this something totally new?
So what Prince is able to do is he's able to pull a few music genres together and effectively create a new music genre. He's pulling from indie rock, he's pulling from rhythm and blues, he's pulling from funk, because this is also after the explosion of James Brown and funk music, and he's pulling from this type of music called synth pop, which was really big in the 70s and 80s, where synthesizers were used. And Prince is drawing on all of this to create what we now know as the Minneapolis sound. And Uptown is a fantastic reflection of that.
All right, we just have a few minutes left, Rashad Shabazz, and I'd just like to kind of consider maybe the ripple effects from Prince's work and how that changed the music industry in general. And maybe this part of the story is why people forget about Minneapolis, because he had such an impact on so many other musicians all over the place.
So once, you know, Prince, you know, explodes in the 70s, but then sort of takes off into the stratosphere in the 1980s with, you know, 1999, and of course, Purple Rain and Sign of the Times. He effectively forges a brand new genre. He is not an R&B artist. He is not a rock star. He is not a funk goddess, and he's not an innovator of synth pop. He's all of those things, plus the creation of the composite of them, right? So he becomes the Minneapolis sound. And the impact this has on popular music is significant. It transforms the latter 20th century and orients it towards the kind of synthesis that Prince begins to really play with when he's a teenager and then perfects throughout his career. Also, people that he went to school with and who worked in bands with him, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, they go on to become super producers, and they work with Janet Jackson, Taylor Swift, and so many other people. So the Minneapolis sound and that fusion of music becomes the epicenter of what late 20th century and early 21st century pop music sounds like. So when you listen to people like Frank Ocean, for example, Frank Ocean is really one of the children of Prince, because Frank is trying to put one foot in R&B, put another foot in rock, and put another foot in this entirely new genre that he's trying to cultivate for himself. But all of these artists, Janelle Monáe, D'Angelo, and so many others, are indebted to Prince, not simply because of his genius, right, which is just unparalleled, but because he gave them a new language by which to do music. And that has had a tremendous impact on 21st century pop music.
I'd like to just hear a short clip from The Bird, which I think a lot of people will recognize. Now, this was not performed by Prince, but tell us a little bit about his contribution.
So Prince had so much music in him. He wrote 44 studio albums. Three of them were double albums. One of them was a triple album. Another one had four discs. He also put away another 20,000 songs that we'll be listening to over the next century. Really just unbelievable work ethic. But he had so much music that he developed all of these alternative groups who he would write, arrange, and produce for. And this was one of the first groups. It was a time that was made up of childhood friends, Morris Day, he went to school with, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis, who I just mentioned. They all went to school together, trained under the same system. He began writing for them in the late 1970s and 80s, and the song that we're going to listen to is one of their biggest hits.
America, have you heard? Brand new dance, it's called the Bird. You don't need no finesse, no personality.
We've been speaking with Rashad Shabazz about the legacy of Prince, but also about the role that Minneapolis as a city and the cultural history of that city played in the cultivation of his own genius. Rashad Shabazz is a human geographer at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
In the news last week, a ship was seized by Somali pirates. They held the ship and the crew for ransom. Those kinds of attacks are pretty rare today, but 10 years ago, they were very common. Tomorrow, here on Constant Wonder, we're going to meet a man who spent 6 weeks as a hostage to Somali pirates, and he has a book out about a little-known operation that saved forgotten crew members who were languishing in captivity. Join with us again tomorrow for Constant Wonder. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.